Hi, this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, and today we're going to talk to a lawyer who's involved in a class action lawsuit against Walmart. As you all know, first of all, welcome to those people who are just joining us for the first time on Occupied Territory, and also those of you who have wandered over from SiriusXM. We do deal with issues here brought up by the Occupy movement, essentially, of course, income inequality and how it's rotting out the rest of our country morally and politically. You know, we've been following this Walmart issue the whole time that ever since actually late summer, with people doing walkouts on jobs, protests, attempting to form a union without legally saying they are, because that involves all kinds of troubles with the NLRB. But recently, one of the newer developments here, well, it's been going on for a while, but one that's come to our attention is something I received in over the email the other day. It says, Walmart sued Friday for massive wage theft at California warehouses. Federal motion, court motion, casts Walmart in central role in decade-long scheme to defraud workers. And we have with us one of the attorneys representing the workers in this case, and it is Kevin Kish, who is with us, who is the director of Employment Rights Project, the Employment Rights Project at Betzedek. Hiya.
Hi, how are you?
Betzedek is what?
Betzedek is a legal aid organization based in Los Angeles that provides free legal services to low-income people, everyone in L.A. County, actually, and sometimes beyond, who need help in various areas, including housing or benefits or consumer fraud, and in this case, in my particular unit, in employment-related violations.
Let me read the first one or two paragraphs here, so then we can go on and talk about the case a little bit. It says here, attorneys representing as many as 1,800 warehouse workers who move goods for Walmart in Southern California's Inland Empire. Is that the name of a company, or is that the empire itself?
Inland Empire refers to a region east of Los Angeles in San Bernardino and Riverside counties.
Huh. Okay. We'll take steps Friday morning to, that's this past Friday, to add Walmart as a defendant in the federal class action known as Carrillo versus Schneider Logistics Incorporated. And there's a part of the problem right away. We'll get to that in a second. Plaintiff warehouse workers seek millions of dollars in reimbursement and penalties from Walmart and the contractors it hired to operate Walmart's warehouse facilities in Riverside County, California. So the lawsuit started out against subcontractors, which Walmart has many of, including overseas, as we read about recently in that tragic fire. But so originally the lawsuit was brought on behalf of workers against other company or companies, right?
That's actually exactly right. The way these particular warehouses are structured, and the lawsuit targets three of them, is that there's actually three levels. So we know that all the goods that come in and out of the warehouses are Walmart goods. The way that it works is that products that are brought in from overseas that come through the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, which are the largest and busiest ports in the country, they come through the port, they are transported to the Inland Empire, this large region east of Los Angeles, where there is a huge warehouse complex for all sorts of companies. One of the biggest warehouse complexes in the world, it's close to highways and rail lines, and at these warehouses, the products are unloaded from the shipping containers or trucks mm-hmm. that come from the port and then redistributed out through the country to distribution centers and ultimately to the stores, not just Walmart stores, of course, basically all sorts of consumer stores. But these three warehouses in the lawsuit handle exclusively Walmart goods. So the only goods that come in and out of them belong to Walmart and are headed to Walmart stores. The actual warehouses are operated, though, by a contractor called Schneider Logistics, which is based in Wisconsin, and which, you know, basically does the day-to-day running of the warehouses. Schneider doesn't actually hire the people who load and unload the trailers, though. They subcontract that out further.
So the first level is the people who have been subcontracted by Schneider. The second level is Schneider.
Right? Exactly right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So,
and then at the top, there's Walmart.
Is it three layers, then, we're talking about?
Three layers, yeah.
It seems to be similar to what happened in when they started investigating what happened at the Bangladesh fire. There was at least two, if not three, layers there, and then Walmart, right?
Well, that's right. And the garment industry is another industry known for these tiers or layers of subcontractors. And in fact, a couple industries have become known for that in the past couple of decades, including agriculture out here in California. Certainly, garment security services have been subcontracted for a long time, and janitorial services as well. Warehouses are doing it now, too.
So when the original lawsuit couldn't be straight against Walmart, you actually had to build up a case by testimony and depositions to prove that it was Walmart actually in charge, right?
That's right. We know what our clients know. Our clients are the guys and women who are loading and unloading the actual boxes on the trucks. And they know what their job is. They know who talks to them on a daily basis. They know who they're getting instructions from. But they don't know what happens in the boardrooms or even in the offices and the warehouses. Who's sort of directing the activities there? Who's pressuring the companies to then pressure the workers to move faster? So when we filed the case, we didn't know. We knew what our workers knew. And over the past year, the case was filed in October of last year, of 2011. Mm-hmm. It's just become increasingly clear that Walmart's fingerprints are all over it. They are involved in basically every aspect of the work performed in the warehouses.
Do the boxes that these people unload from the container ship containers say Walmart on them?
Many of them do, yes.
Well, there's a clue. No.
There's a clue. I mean, legally, Walmart could have its boxes moved by anyone.
That's true.
If they weren't supervising it, if they weren't controlling it, they could hire a company and have them transported across the country, or we could all do that. But that's not what the evidence is showing in this case. We know that there's a Walmart manager on site who is involved.
Oh, really?
Involved in daily meetings with supervisors from the other companies to discuss every aspect of the way this freight is moving through the warehouses. We know that he goes on rounds to check down to the level of detail of whether boxes are being loaded onto pallets correctly, according to Walmart best practices. So the warehouses are run here in exactly the same manner that Walmart runs warehouses that it controls directly, because there are some warehouses that Walmart just runs directly without subcontracting out, and other warehouses where it subcontracts the work. And what the evidence is suggesting is that there's no difference. They're the same Walmart policies in place, the same procedures that are used, the same conditions and standards that are imposed from the top by Walmart.
Now, why are you suing on behalf of these workers? What is the reason?
Sure. That's a really good question. The workers have presented to the court over the past year evidence essentially of massive wage fraud, down to the level that many people were not getting paid even minimum wage, much less overtime. Then there are a series of related violations. One of them is record-keeping violations. What turned out is that the workers had no idea how much they were getting paid. They had no idea what their pay rate was because they weren't getting paid by the hour. They were getting paid a piece rate by the number of containers that were unloaded at the warehouses. And so the evidence is not only that the subcontractors were falsifying the hours on a daily basis, systematically, that people actually worked. But the workers had no way of actually calculating their wages because many times it was a group piece rate, meaning that the companies would somehow combine the value or assign a value, a money value, a dollar value to each container. Mm-hmm. And then, so for example, a container would be worth $50, and anybody who unloaded that container would get a share of that $50 based on the number of people.
At least a couple of people or more would be unloading one container, right?
Generally two people. One of the group piece rate practices was, at least at certain periods, all of the value of all of the containers unloaded in a certain day would be added together and then divided by all of the workers who unloaded or loaded any container on that day.
But
so
was
the workers didn't know how many were there.
So it was sufficiently abstract and abstruse so that people couldn't really say, I make $8 an hour, I make $12 an hour, I deserve this, I worked overtime. That wasn't clear, right?
Not only could the workers not tell it, the lawyers couldn't tell it when we looked at their pay stubs. And the California Labor Commissioner, the state labor agency, actually conducted a raid of the warehouses and cited the subcontractors, the companies who directly hire the workers, for precisely this problem.
Mm-hmm.
The workers would sometimes approach their managers and say, I think that I was underpaid for this day. And when they did so, the evidence is that there was a culture of pervasive retaliation. They wouldn't be called back to work the next day.
Mm-hmm.
They would sometimes be fired or suspended. They would be told not to ask or that they wouldn't have a job.
Now, aside from this retaliation and the fact that they had no idea what they deserve to be paid, I guess the other part is that, and this happens with the other Walmart cases in terms of the retail stores and distribution places, but especially retail stores. Now, Walmart will not hire people if they can help on any kind of regular, predictable, full-time basis. They tell people the day before that they're not working. They'll tell you you get 5 hours this week and you're going to get no hours next week and we may change that. Whatever is best. They have something called employment software, which is pretty insidious when you think of it. Employee software? I forget what it's called, but they figure out how to keep people from earning a full-time salary, you know.
Right. So one of the interesting things about these workers is that they're all classified as temporary workers.
Mm.
So these agencies that are hiring them are temporary staffing agencies. So there are some cases, some people involved in the lawsuit who have been working in the same warehouses on a daily basis for years, who have no expectation that when they show up the next day, they're going to have a job. And that obviously leads to conditions where, if you want to, you can get rid of anybody who complains.
Mm-hmm. And what about the working conditions? Is that part of the lawsuit?
It is, yeah. The working conditions are very tough anyway, even under the best circumstances. This is heavy labor. It's lifting and loading and unloading boxes of merchandise. So,
but that's part of a lot of different jobs.
Yeah. Right, that's part of the job. It's not an easy job. The heat is a problem, and we believe that there are violations of heat regulations. The temperatures in these containers, especially in the summertime, can soar to well over 100 degrees. We know that the workers were not getting the breaks that were mandated by state law.
Mm-hmm.
It's dusty. They are working without equipment in these warehouses. These particular workers don't use the types of tools that are frequently used in other warehouses. They aren't allowed to touch the forklifts, for example. So everything is done by hand, and there are some allegations in the complaint about the heat conditions, for example.
So they unload these heavy containers by hand that they don't
That's
use
right.
forklifts? Really?
Yeah. The forklifts are used to move pallets. Everything
right.
is loaded onto a pallet. But during the period that the lawsuit covers, everybody was moving everything by hand.
And if you don't work at a certain rate, are you removed from the job or?
Right. So there are targets, and it's called cases per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the evidence that's emerged over the past year is that this is a standard imposed by Walmart. So you might have a case per hour target rate of 60, meaning that each worker would be expected to move, load, or unload 60 cases per hour.
Do you know the average weight of a case?
No, and that changed. So it certainly was possible to unload some containers in a relatively reasonable period of time and meet a case per hour standard. It was not possible for other containers to do that. And so the actual rate that workers were being paid varied wildly,
mm-hmm.
depending on what was actually contained in the containers. And we estimate that in some circumstances, the actual rate, if you translated it into an hourly rate, was as low as $4 or $5 an hour, which, of course, is drastically below minimum wage.
Another thing is, not to pick on poor China, of course, but, who knows what the conditions are like when these things are loaded in, the materials these things are made of in the first place. You could walk into one of these containers And it could be full of toxic dust, right? It could be full of all kinds of things. They don't vacuum.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The conditions are in the warehouses are very dusty themselves. And, you know, I don't know what's in there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a problem with the supply chain as a whole.
Right.
If the company that controls the supply chain isn't concerned with the conditions in that chain, then they don't change because there's always an incentive to do things more quickly, cheaper. The companies that are subcontracted will always have that incentive.
Well, you know, some things never change. I was watching a documentary on New York, and they talked all about the garment industry and the Triangle Shirtwaist fire.
Yeah.
And what you're describing is, of course, not as severe in any way like this, but it's part of the continuum. In other words, keep working, work fast. We're not going to tell you how much you get, but if you stop working for a second, you're fired. If you say one word, you're fired. All of this kind of stuff. You know.
Yeah, it's they are conditions that have sort of returned to conditions that were prevalent at the beginning of the industrial era in the late 1800s, early 1900s. You know, in Los Angeles, we do have a large garment industry. My organization, BetSedek, represents a lot of garment workers as well.
Uh-huh.
And there are over 5,000 garment factories in Los Angeles County. And, you know, some of them are legitimate, and some of them have conditions that are exactly like the Triangle Shirtwaist factory, where workers are actually locked into the factory overnight from the outside. So if there were a fire, they couldn't escape.
Well, that's what happened in Bangladesh. It's almost a complete duplication of the Triangle Shirtwaist factory, and including from the employer's end and the employees. So what are you looking for? What do you want? What are the remedies that you expect to get, that you demand to get?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, wages. These workers have had literally millions of dollars of wages stolen out of their pockets.
Mm-hmm.
So we want them to be reimbursed for the work that they did. It was hard work. They deserve to be paid at least at the minimum wage. And then more broadly, the idea I think the workers would love to see an overall change in the way the industry is structured. The industry was not always structured like this.
Oh, really? Was it once better?
Sure, yeah. 20 years ago or even longer, these were jobs that, of course, there weren't as many of these jobs. These were jobs that paid a relatively high wage. They were never jobs that were going to make anybody rich, but you could make $15 an hour. You could make even higher. The piece rate system that mm-hmm. was imposed really just slashed everybody's wages. And the reality is that when the workers are brought on, so for example, in our case, after the case was filed, one of these subcontractors terminated its contract, meaning that about 100 workers were immediately going to lose their jobs. And the federal court where the case is filed enjoined that, stopped that from happening,
mm-hmm.
and said, I'm not going to tell you companies how to fix this, but these workers can't be fired because it seems to me retaliation. It seems to me that
right.
you could just get rid of the entire workforce. And what ended up happening is that the contractor hired the workers on directly at a slightly higher wage. I think it was about $11 an hour, which is above minimum wage. And the workers were very, very pleased with that. It's not, again, going to make anybody rich. But I think one of the lessons is if you treat someone with a minimum of respect. They know what they're getting paid. They know what to expect. They know that if they work a certain number of hours, they're going to get paid a certain amount of money. That is, in many cases, enough to make somebody feel that their work is valued and that they want to contribute to the project of whatever is going on in the warehouses. So overall,
So what you're looking for is back wages. Are you looking for some kind of punitive damages because they basically you can't? I mean, their lifestyle was severely, to use a certain phrase, was severely affected by being underpaid for so long. I mean,
yes.
Shouldn't people pay for that?
Yes, they should. So if the only remedy were back wages, nobody would ever have an incentive to pay legally because the worst thing that could happen is that at the end of the day, you would be forced to pay what you should have paid in the first place.
Right.
So there are additional damages related to the claims that are in the lawsuit. One of them is liquidated damages under state and federal law, which means basically twice what you were owed for mm-hmm. minimum wage and overtime. And then there are fines associated with some of the claims, and then punitive damages where you have to show that the conduct was willful, was malicious, and that's a possibility.
This may be maybe this actually sort of is a rhetorical or slightly naive question, but why were things better and why did they get worse?
That is a great question. I think about that a lot in the context of the garment industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the answers are vary widely, and I think there are a lot of different factors. One factor is that there are always going to be people who are willing to exploit others, and if they are given the chance to do so, will do it. When do they have the chance to do so? Well, in the garment industry, for example, it used to be after the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, it was a unionized industry. That fire galvanized the labor movement. And then slowly over the course of the last century, the factories moved to non-union areas to the south, ultimately overseas. It has to do in that industry with the World Trade Organization lifting certain quotas, meaning that other countries can export to our country higher amounts of garments. And it ended up being an industry once again that was staffed by an overwhelmingly immigrant female workforce, hidden away in small factories in a state, California, that despite having a pretty large labor agency, doesn't have anywhere near the resources it would need to actually regulate these workplaces.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, something similar has happened with warehouses. They're located in the middle of nowhere. It's an overwhelmingly immigrant workforce. Many people don't know about their rights. It is, you know, we don't have the state or the federal regulators that could go out and do site visits on any sort of regular basis to mm-hmm. ensure that laws are being complied with. So you sort of have deregulation, you have under-enforcement, and you have people who are willing to take advantage of a vulnerable workforce.
And also, this obviously, what you the question was meant to set up the answer, and the answer was a perfect answer. Is this what you're doing here is like turning a key in one small door, which ultimately, you know, swings open to reveal the entire thing inside, right? You know, that includes, you know, because this is huge warehouse hubs in, you know, in Illinois and other places, too. And then basically you're talking about a worldwide situation. You're talking about globalization. This is the underside of globalization, right?
I think that's right. I think part of the role of this case, but also of all forms of advocacy around these types of jobs, is to simply make them visible.
Mm.
We don't see them. These warehouses are located on the sides of highways in areas that, you know, they aren't surrounded by homes or schools. They're out in areas where you don't see them,
right.
Even though you might drive past them on your car. And when you walk into a store, you pick up an item to purchase, you don't necessarily, you may actually think about, oh, where was this manufactured? You can see it on a label mm-hmm. sometimes. But you don't think, this had to get into my hands somehow.
Especially these days, you don't see things because you just go on and look at a screen and click on something.
Right, you can just click on it.
Yeah.
And it's easy to keep invisible or under wraps the human labor that that creates every product that we touch on a day-to-day basis.
Well, if you just tune in, we're listening to Kevin Kish, who is a director of the Employment Rights Project at BetZedek. Where are you? The last question, I guess, is where are you with this case? I mean, you're at what point? I mean, are you in front of a jury, in front of a judge? When do you expect some sort of initial decision or whatever?
Sure. Well, over the course of the past year, we've actually received three preliminary injunctions from the federal judge. One to order the companies to start keeping records so that workers could actually know what they were being paid, and another to stop the termination of the 100 workers whose contract who worked for the company that ended its contract. And now the court will hear on January 7th. The question of adding Walmart into the case. We've asked for permission to add Walmart as a defendant. That will be heard on January 7th. And then right now the deadlines are later in January. We have a motion for class certification that's due to be filed. So
What could Walmart possibly say to excuse themselves from being included?
I think we'll have to wait and see what they'll say. But certainly the position of many of these companies is that we just aren't involved.
Oh, I see.
We have subcontracted out this work, and there are some valid reasons why you might want to subcontract out this work. Flexibility is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't do it and then maintain the level of control that we believe Walmart maintained and still create that barrier saying that you have no responsibility for what happened.
Well, you know, in Berlin, they didn't know what was happening in the camps. It happens all the time like that. Let's see. I'm sorry for the extraordinary comparison there, but it gets to me sometimes. It's really, you know, outrageous. So, well, I'm glad you're doing this. Is there a way that people... Oh, one last question. I'm sorry. As far as unionization goes, obviously, unions were once the solution to all of these outrages, and to me, it seems like they should be again. Maybe you can't take a position on that. Maybe it wouldn't be good for your clients to be doing that. But, you know, clearly with all these walkouts in the retail stores and with this kind of thing in the warehouses and what happens everywhere is the answer, aside from government regulation, which doesn't appear to be forthcoming, would be unions, right?
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of – or sort of corporate responsibility. Although,
oh, well, forget about that. I mean, really, you know.
I mean, there are all different forms of advocacy. So the case, for example, the case that we're,
right.
that we're prosecuting – you know, is relying on the courts, is relying on the law to remedy situations that we believe are in violation of very fundamental labor standards. Another option, of course, is organizing, not even necessarily in a formal union, just sort of worker solidarity. And, of course, there is a vigorous organizing effort in place at these warehouses that's just a different avenue for trying to achieve work that has dignity.
Well, you know, none of these original unions from the turn of the century before whatever have happened without massive civil disobedience and strikes and whatever the government wants. The government was paid off by the city of New York in those cases. So where can people go to find out more and perhaps help out this effort?
Sure. Well, my organization is called Betzedek, B-E-T-T-Z-E-D-E-K. It means House of Justice in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And we have wonderful co-counsel, including Altshuler Berzon in San Francisco, Sandra Munoz in Los Angeles, Traber and Voorhees in Pasadena. And to learn more about the sort of overall conditions in the warehouse industry in particular, there is an organization, Warehouse Workers United, which is sort of spearheading some organizing out there. And they maintain a website with information about what's going on.
Well, I hope for the best, and I'm really I'm glad to speak to somebody who's putting themselves on the line like that. You get out of law school, you could do all kinds of things, but you're doing the right thing as far as I'm concerned. So thank you.
You know? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Okay, that's Kevin Kish, who is Director of Employment Rights Project at Betzedek, which is an organization that tries to promote social justice, and basically they're interested in they'll help you out if you have trouble with immigration, with discrimination and various things with employment rights. This is happening with Walmart. Now, Walmart is something we're going to continue to pursue because, as I've mentioned before on this program and other places, Walmart is the key because it's symbolic, because it's so massive. I mean, there are 1.4, as I mentioned before, again on this program, there are 1.4 million workers in this country alone employed by Walmart. 1.4 million. This is people who are directly employed by Walmart or who are, you know, Walmart is hide behind certain subcontractors, but it's all nonsense, of course. Basically, you're talking about retail store workers, people who work behind the scenes in retail stores, you know, who are preparing meat or wrapping packages or unloading or loading things. And then you have people at the warehouses and people at distribution centers. And, there are individual trucking subcontractors and truckers that work in and out of Walmart. I don't think they have their own trucking or trucks yet, but eventually that will happen. This is one of these things. Why Teddy Roosevelt actually decided to fight to break up monopolies. This is Walmart, right? And if Walmart can be forced, either both through using federal law and state and federal law to come up with decent wages, with decent hours, with a decent work situation and treat people correctly, if they paid people a decent wage. Now, before Kevin was talking about corporate responsibility. Corporate responsibility is nothing but a joke. In fact, corporate responsibility is a direct contradiction in terms. Corporate responsibility. The only responsibility they have is to make a lot of money. Well, good. That's the capitalist system. As long as we're going along with that, they're doing a great job at Walmart. They're making their shareholders, I suppose, if there are shareholders, if I don't know if it's a private company or publicly traded, they're making their executives and they're making their owners very, very, very rich. As we've mentioned before, each one of the Walmart siblings who are inherited the Walmart fortune from the original founders is has about $25 billion each one of them in assets. And as I've mentioned before on this program, you do the math, an overused phrase, but I just used it anyhow. If you took one of these Walmart siblings who, let's say, has $25 billion and sold all that money, cashed in this woman or this man's stock holdings in Walmart, all their assets, all their stocks that they hold personally, all the land, all the other companies that they're invested in, if you cashed in all their assets and their net worth and what they make each year, that would be about $25 billion. Just one of them, one sibling alone, if you just cashed in it all, and, you know, the other brothers and sisters could help out. Maybe they could hire somebody to, you know, they could pay for somebody to polish their fifth Cadillac or whatever it is that they need. $25 billion could hire every one of the 1.4 million workers in this country who work in some connection with Walmart, could pay them $40,000 a year, lift them out of poverty, and $40,000 is not much in this society, could lift them all out of poverty and give them decent health insurance. And they would, of course, start buying things, guess where? At Walmart's. And it would increase the business at Walmart. They would buy things in communities and neighborhoods. It would be one of the ways to massively turn around the American economy, just this one company. So you see why Walmart and what's happening at Walmart is so absolutely essential to what's going on in the entire country in terms of income inequality, wages, labor, and what needs to be done. Now, the other thing, since there's no corporate responsibility at all anymore, that's an old, laughable phrase. You're looking at government regulations, and when you got a Republican Party who wants no government at all and tries to destroy anything that resembles a regulation, and they've been pretty successful. Why? Because of the cooperation of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is basically Republican Lite, L-I-T-E. So between the two of them, the SEC going after banks, they settle with a company, let's say some banking company, that has robbed this country and the world of $100 billion. They'll settle for $400 million, which is like a nickel in the pocket of one of these banks, right? So the government regulators don't do their job. Government regulations have been broken down and laws have been thrown overboard. And when they attempt to make new laws, people stand in the way and don't let them function correctly. So you can't trust the government. You can try to go through the courts. Right now, the courts, when they're not overly Republicanized, you know, appointed by various Republican presidents, will probably give you a better break and are routinely giving people a better break when it comes to civil rights and employment rights than the Congress. The Congress is basically a conservative, even right-wing organization that people have nothing but contempt for because of the way they've acted towards the average American. What was the last rating, favorable rating, whatever that means, was 9% for Congress. What was it, about a year ago, Americans were asked in a poll to rate whether the favorability of various organizations. Congress was 9%. The Communist Party, which barely exists at all, which doesn't really exist in America, was at 11%. Nothing is more contemptible, in other words, in America than our representative government body. That's bad news if you're a regular American, middle class, or you're a worker, right? So what am I building up to here? There's got to be massive civil disobedience, i.e. strikes and unionization. The only way that unions were ever formed, ever in this country, and the only way they'll ever be formed again is by disobeying the corporate-ruled government, you know, that's in charge. In New York City and in other places, Chicago, all over the country, out west, wherever, in the Longshoremen's Union in the East Coast and the West Coast, out in Oakland and San Diego, no place in mining camps, railroad workers' yards in Chicago, no place has there ever been unions on a large, effective level, coal miners in West Virginia, where there wasn't disobedience, strikes, blocking, activity at these places, stopping activity at these places, pitched battles with cops, with soldiers. It's going to happen again because you cannot trust this government to look out for workers. They are more than half the members of Congress are millionaires, and that's the way it is. So we can't look to them. So we've got the courts we can try to rely on because it still sends some decency there. And then we've got unionization and workers' protests. That's what we've got to look for. And that's why we're following this and why we're trying to promote this as much as possible. We're going to take a slight break, and then we're going to come back. Okay. Now, once again, this is Occupied Territory. You're listening to Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, hosted by Mike Fader. The show, once again, for those of you who are new to it or who have come over from Sirius XM, because I mention it over there on that program, is basically, it's not about the Middle East. I was thinking of trying to rename the show and call it Occupied Territory America or America Occupied Territory. But I'd have to change the Facebook page. I'm not sure how to do that. But I'll find out, because people might get confused. I'm not talking about what's going on in the Middle East right now. That's a whole separate conversation for other times, which we can do on this show. But basically, this is about America. It's about income inequality, and which is the main issue brought up by the Occupy movement. Now, ancillary to this show is a kind of parallel formation with this show is our Facebook page, and it's called Occupied Territory. So I want everybody to participate in that. Google Occupied Territory and Facebook. Every couple of days, I will post a new article that I see somewhere, which I think is essential for people to read, which is revealing and essential, and which is keep us abreast of basically how our government is not representing us and the way that people are taking actions. And I try on this show as much as possible to interview regular citizens or people who are down and out or oppressed, which is about 90% of most of us in this country at this point, who are trying to block the what looks like the inevitable progress, the juggernaut progress of corporate government or government corporations. It's all the same thing. So, for instance, we're going to try to get some people who got arrested out in Texas last week by sitting in, and actually in one case, actually sitting inside part of the XL pipeline, which is being constructed in Texas. Now, a lot of you who have followed this XL pipeline thing, and this is where a large Canadian company with relationship to the to the usual suspects, you know, in this country, the Koch brothers and whatever, Halliburton. But a large Canadian company wants to transport by a gigantic pipeline that's going to cost billions of dollars to build and maintain. They want to transport the worst, the most polluting carbon-based fuel component for fuel, tar sands, oil tar sands from northern Canada. They want to transport it across Canada, polluting Canada, by the way, too, and they want to transport it straight through bisecting the middle of the United States, which will go right over, right on top of some of the largest aquifers in the country, supplying water, hopefully clean water, until they get through polluting it, that at least now, generally clean water, to tens of millions of people. And there's already been leaks from this pipe, you know, sections of this pipeline. There have been leaks from the same company that's involved here. I think it's called TransCanada, but I'm not really sure. And people are protesting this more and more, and people are getting arrested on this. And so that's what this show is about. And so go to the Facebook page, check in every day, and you can like it or be a friend, and you'll get notified. And you can join in. You got opinions about things. I'll post articles. You can post videos. Occupied Territory. All right. Speaking of things, and all these things are related. Recently in New York City, and all these things are sort of related, like the fire in Bangladesh, that was a Walmart garment factory, the walkouts at the Walmart stores. In New York City, a lot of fast food workers who are paid at an abysmal rate, something like the average is something like $8.69 an hour, right? And this is after they've worked for a year or two. People who are paid at a rate which actually puts them in poverty at fast food places, and there are hundreds of thousands in New York City and a couple of million in the country, walked out. A lot of, I didn't say that they all walked out, but a lot of people walked out of McDonald's, Wendy's, whatever, you know, Burger King. They walked out of these places. And like I say, it wasn't a large action. Just like the walkouts that occurred on Black Friday, or is it Black Thursday now too? And before that, at the Walmart retail stores, weren't large actions. It was a handful of people in each case, maybe 10, 20 here and there. But it's more and more and more, and it's building. And it's an attempt to unionize. Ultimately, it's an attempt to unionize for decent wages. These jobs, even if they are not considered to be prestigious jobs, and they are not jobs which, frankly, take a tremendous amount of education or even necessarily extraordinarily high intelligence, are hard goddamn jobs. these people have to lift heavy cartons. They have to be inside. They have to deal with customers all day long. They have to be on their feet all day long. They have to fry this poison meat with cheese on these grills all day long and inhale this crap. This is a hard job. And there are tens of millions of people who get pizza and burgers and Big Macs and Small Macs and whatever it is that they get. And Wendy's Busto Burgers. You know, tens of millions of Americans live on this junk. And I would live on some pizza junk, too, if I could, but I can't actually digest it. So I want to include myself. But tens of millions of people buy this stuff. They have no regard for these workers at all, right? This is looked upon with contempt by most people. Where you work? Work in McDonald's. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, these are hard jobs. And if they didn't do them, if suddenly all these people said, no, we're not going to work for slave labor wages anymore. We're not going to work under such conditions. We're not going to work like this anymore. We're stopping right now. If everybody did it all at once, imagine what would happen in this country. I'm talking about 10 million people, 20 million people in the course of one day wouldn't get their pizza delivery, wouldn't get their fast food for lunch. I mean, it would be a tremendous thing. But you have to build up to this. This has to be built up to. And all these things are related, like Walmart and this. Now, there's a long article in the Times the other day, but and I'm going to read for a little bit of it and skip it. It says, let's say, because I can't read the whole article, unionizing the bottom of the pay scale. And there's a main point here, but I'll start it off. Other than poverty, Jose Carrillo and Joshua Williams have little in common. The austere life of Mr. Carrillo, a 79-year-old Peruvian immigrant from Washington Heights in New York City, is a universe apart from the hardscrabble reality of Mr. Williams, a 28-year-old single father from Atlanta staying in his aunt's place in Brooklyn to save on rent. But their lives are connected. They both work in the fast food industry. Mr. Carrillo at a McDonald's in Midtown Manhattan and Mr. Williams at a Wendy's in Brooklyn. They both earn a little more. And when I say, you know, Manhattan and Brooklyn, think of, you know, some neighborhood in Chicago or whatever, Los Angeles or anywhere. They both earn a little more than $7 an hour, and they both need food stamps to survive. Last Thursday, both did something they never did before. They went on strike. Their activism, part of a flash strike of some 200 workers from fast food restaurants around New York City, caps a string of unorthodox actions sponsored by organized labor, including worker protests outside Walmart, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, one of the important things is here, in fact, the essential part of this article is that we've got several million people, maybe 10 million people in this country between Walmart's fast food places and think of all the other kinds of low-level jobs where people are making around $8 an hour, maybe an average of $8 an hour. And the working conditions are harsh and difficult. There's no unions. The bosses can retaliate in almost any way they want. People get laid off. They don't have regular hours. Health insurance is poor, right? Now, according to this writer here, it says, Mr. Carrillo and Mr. Williams' meager salaries also underscore the straightforward choice we face as a nation. And here's the essential point. Either we build an economy in which most workers can earn enough to adequately support their families, or we build a government with the wherewithal to subsidize the existence of a lower class that can't survive on its own. We are doing neither. More than 2 million workers toil in food preparation jobs at limited service restaurants like McDonald's, et cetera, et cetera. So there's the point. There's the point here. The point is that we have 10 million, maybe 20 million people in this country who are working at these jobs where they make between $7 and $9 an hour. They are living in poverty. They live on food stamps. They get all kinds of welfare. They get Medicaid benefits. In other words, your taxes, my taxes, and certainly, but except for the rich people's taxes, because they try not to pay any, or they pay half of what we pay. The government of the United States, or the government of the state of New York, or the state of Illinois, or wherever it is, pays for these people to keep living. We give them housing aid. We give them food stamps. We give them other welfare benefits. If we didn't, they would die. Now, we're involved here in a kind of a moral choice. We're involved in a moral choice. And unfortunately, we can't escape the fact that we're involved in it. We can avoid it. We don't have to pay attention when we order out the pizza. We don't have to do anything but give a tip to the delivery person if we're in the middle class. If you're in the middle class, you won't be in it long, by the way. middle class doesn't mean middle class anymore. There is a disappearing middle class in this country. If you make between $50,000 and $100,000, it's worth about two-thirds of what it was 20 years ago in terms of buying power. One thing that never goes down is the cost of anything. There are more and more monopolies all the time. Now, I'm talking about middle-class values. If you have cable or you whatever, if you're involved with cell phones and if you have cable for cable TV, you know, when you want to buy gas for your car, you want to buy – you have basic things that you need, utilities, energy, heat, you know, communications. If you have these things, you know that it never stops going up because they are monopolies and the government does not control them. Now, one of the things you may have heard if you were listening earlier – to the interview with Kevin Kish, the lawyer for this social justice law firm, was that people see this as invisible. In other words, these workers' conditions are invisible. They won't be so invisible soon when we sink into the same place. And that's what income inequality is all about. So basically what's happening is our taxes are going to stay high. And you see the tremendous effort that rich people and their hired prostitutes, otherwise known as Congress people and senators, are making to keep people rich and having not to pay taxes or their fair share of taxes. There are lower taxes now on rich people than there have been in the last, 60, 70 years. The tax rate is lower on rich people than it's been. And rich people are making more money than they ever made before relative to in real terms and relative to the rest of the population. So who pays for all of this? The rich people don't pay for it. Poor people don't pay for it. They don't have the money. We pay for it. If we're in the middle class, and I think probably most people listening to me are in the middle class, and I'm saying that you earn between $40,000 and let's say $80,000, most of the people listening to me right now, you earn $60,000, $70,000 together as a family or maybe one of you or whatever who's working. The prices of everything keep going up because there are monopolies. If Time Warner or whoever, Comcast or whoever provides your cable service, wants to tack on another $5 a month for some outrageous, made-up, abstract thing that they decided that you have to pay for, there's not a damn thing you can do about it. And one of the things the Republicans want to do, and the Democrats who go along with them, or like little sheep don't say anything about it, is they want to constantly keep breaking down what few rules remain. The SEC, the EPA, the FCC, the FDA, whatever it is that – whatever bad they do in the world – and I know a lot of programs on this station are, you know, are rail against places like the FDA and other places and for righteous reasons. But the main reason for that is because they are in the thrall, in the pay of corporations. Most state environmental protection departments or environmental protection agencies have been decimated by state Republican legislatures and governors. They barely exist anymore. In places like West Virginia, the Environmental Protection Agency is basically a paid subsidiary in a lot of cases of the coal industry. And when they're not, because I don't want to tar everybody, to use a certain phrase, with the same brush, when they're not in the pay of these people, there's just too few of them. These agencies have been cut. The agencies that are responsible for patrolling these monopolistic, anti-human companies in communications, in energy, you know, the fracking companies, the gas companies, the coal companies, the oil companies, you know, Time Warner Communications companies, whoever it is that overcharges us, nobody is doing anything about it. Banks. And as I mentioned earlier, the SEC, once every 2 or 3 months, the Securities and Exchange Commission or some other federal agency like the Justice Department will settle with a place like Barclays Bank or UBS or some gigantic international bank or huge American bank. And you read the fines that they're settling for. $400 million. $400 million when, for instance, UBS was involved in setting falsely and illegally the rates for which every other bank could borrow money so that it jacked up the rates for students, for mortgage, for everybody who borrows anything from a bank. And you're talking about hundreds of millions of people all over the world to finance their lives or to live a somewhat halfway decent life. Anything you borrow, the rate is artificially high because they set this whole thing up because of monopoly collusion behind the scenes. Now, banks are being investigated and sued, and our representative government settles with a bank that made something like $100 billion in profit and cheated everybody out of trillions of dollars that they would have to pay in higher loans than were necessary. They settled for $400 million. There's no mistake why most people in this country with half a brain or anybody who's even slightly aware understands that our representative government does not work for us anymore. It does not work for us anymore. The Occupy movement, which gave birth to this program, and the ideas and the value of the Occupy movement posit or state, not to be too academic, that the reality that we sort of see or that we think we see is really true. If we don't act on our own, if we don't form unions, if we don't have massive protests and civil disobedience, if we don't stand in the doorways of these places, if we don't stop them, they will eat us up. It will become like something from a Terminator, like Skynet, where the machines took over. Corporations are doing this all the time, and nothing stands in their way. They have no use for human beings. We are ants. We are flies. We are roaches to them, unless we stand up. Unless we stand up and we go right back to W.E.B. Du Bois, who said, and you should read the whole quote, power concedes nothing without a demand. We cannot rely. We have relied in this country passively far too long. And there are reasons for that, because the middle class had been pretty successful and we had gotten along pretty well until the housing bubble burst for 40, 50 years. Wages had gone up. Had kept pace with costs. It had outpaced costs in some cases. Union jobs paid enough so that people could buy a house, could buy a car, what's called, quote unquote, the American dream. You could live a decent life, send your kids to school, not go broke for your whole life. But no more, no more. The middle class is rapidly disappearing. But that's who still, and one of the reasons we're disappearing is, and it is disappearing, the middle class, is because the rich won't pay their share. Prices keep going up artificially in almost every way, and the poor don't have the money to pay. So who's going to pay? The middle class. And we pay and pay and pay. They take the money out of our paychecks. We pay at the end. We pay an average of like 30% in taxes, even with deductions, 28% in taxes, even with deductions. And everybody, like, to be honest, everybody knows that they try to cheat the government. And you know what? It's only right to cheat the government. It would be stupid and actually almost at this point immoral not to cheat the IRS. I mean, who is going to pay them every penny that they demand, knowing that they're taking your money and killing people with it, that they are working for corporations with it, that they are doing the bidding of corporations, that they work for corporations? Who is going to pay them that money willingly? Nobody, which is why they take it out of your check. They take it out of your check. You're a sheep. You're a child. They're not going to be able to fleece you or to abuse you unless the law makes you do it. Nobody in their right mind is going to keep giving what little money they make, what portion of what little money they make, such a huge portion to the government. When you got a man running for president just recently who makes $250 million, who has $250 million, who makes $20 million a year, doesn't even make it, man does not have an honest job for the last 40 years. A guy like that, Romney, you know, we're forgetting his name already, which is a good thing, I suppose, but don't forget it too much. A guy like that gets $20 million a year on interest payments, you know, some arcane setup that his sleazy accountant set up for him somewhere in the Cayman Islands. Man pays 15% taxes. Rich people routinely, they make $100 million a year, or they get $20 million a year, or $10 million a year, or $1 billion a year, for all I know, and pay a third of the taxes that we do, who work at real jobs, generally trying to help real people do real things. We can't put up with this anymore. And we have to stick with these workers. We have to stick with these workers, because they're carrying not just cartons from Walmart. They're carrying not just heavy packages of fast food deliveries. They're carrying our entire value system and our way of life on their shoulders when they lift these things. That's why we have to stick up for them. When garment workers went on strike in 1911 after dying in a horrendous fire because of work conditions, because there's no control on corporations, people understood it. It came right through their heads. It came right through their hearts. They understood that these people were dying for our sake. They were walking a picket line for our sake. They were getting beat up by thugs hired by corporations for our sake. It's no different now. When you see people who are occupying a place like they did in the Occupy movement, when you see people striking, when you see people protesting, when you see this kind of thing, we have to back these people. They are us. They are us. The rich are going to eat us if we don't keep moving and go after them. If we stand still, they will eat us down to the last cell in our bodies. That's what this show is all about.